We've got a very special guest for y'all today. We've got Rabbi Pinchas Taylor. Rabbi Taylor is rabbi here in South Florida. He's also the director of the American Faith Coalition. Rabbi Taylor, you've been a friend for a few years now. Thanks so much for joining the program.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So why don't we start with the American Faith Coalition? What is it and what are you doing with that?
Sure. So outside the scope of what a lot of rabbis are doing, most rabbis are involved in their own Jewish community, their synagogues, and so forth. I'm bridging a little bit out as well, talking to the non-Jewish world. One of the interesting things I think that you'll find, one of the things that always interested me about Judaism was the idea that Jews believe you don't have to be a Jew to be right with God, to live a successful, moral, righteous life, to be welcomed into the afterlife. It's something that we welcome everybody. And so there are a lot of people outside of the Jewish world that for various reasons are very interested in Jewish wisdom. And I'm happy to be a resource in helping connect them to understanding either their own faith, understanding the Hebrew Bible, understanding some of the details and ideas that that go beyond what they perhaps learned growing up in their own churches.
So I personally, Rabbi, I grew up, my best friend from childhood was actually a fairly religious Christian. I've been passionate about Jewish-Christian relations my entire life, actually. And I've always liked when Rabbi Daniel Lappin, when Dennis Prager, when any of these kind of very public-facing Jewish conservatives talk about these issues, and I'm so happy that you're taking it head on. I want to talk a little bit about the big Passover holiday that we will be celebrating this coming week. But before I do so, I actually want to just kind of continue on this point that you just made there, which is, to me, this is a very under-discussed point. So I actually had a very informal Jewish upbringing. I was actually a two-time Hebrew school dropout, somewhat of a rebellious child. And I've done a lot of education myself. And when I first started learning about the Noahide laws, the seven laws of Noah, which are essentially the seven laws that Judaism says non-Jews, Gentiles have to abide by in order to make it to the world to come, I was blown away by this. I mean, this is only seven laws compared to the 613 that the Jews have to keep. Can you just expand on that point? Because I think this is a very underappreciated point about the Jewish worldview, actually.
Right. So the seven laws are basically a moral code that was originally given to Adam and Eve, according to our tradition. There's a verse in the Torah which the seven laws are derived from. Actually, it was only the original, the first six, and then the seventh law was given to Noah after the flood. Because and there had to be some sort of moral code. If you're a Bible reader, there had to be some sort of moral code already established already with Adam and Eve. Otherwise, God is not really justified in punishing the people, right? You can't punish people for sin if you don't tell them what's a sin, what's right and wrong. These seven laws were the basic moral code that civilized humanity. And that's basically to believe and worship God and only God. Secondly, not to curse God, right? Blasphemy. The third is against murder. The fourth law, and there's no particular order. It's pretty relevant. The third is against murder. Fourth, against theft, stealing. The fifth, against immoral sexual relationships. The sixth law is against eating the limb of a live animal, meaning animal cruelty, ironically enough, interestingly enough. And the seventh law is the one positive law, right? The others are do nots. The seventh law is to establish courts of justice that enforce the other six.
Right.
And so that is really the force that undergirds any sort of moral society. I'm very much a fan of America, very much American patriot, because America was very much founded upon those principles. Whether they called it the Noahide laws or not, the premise was that we're going to establish a God-based society that strengthened our connection, that tried to live a moral and righteous life, which is so beautiful.
Yeah, it really is. You know, I think back to my friend Yoram Hazony, his book, The Virtue of Nationalism, in 2018, where he talks about how the Ten Commandments is, to use his language, a quote, moral minimum that nations should abide by. And then they have a lot of leeway to do whatever is within their customs and traditions. But there has to be some sort of moral minimum. And he traced it to the Ten Commandments. The Noahide laws, I think, would be another perfectly reasonable place to start. You know, very interesting, by the way, talking about how one of these laws, and we'll transition after this, but how one of these laws is about eating live animals. I just can't help but note the irony of that, given that there are all these attempts to ban kosher slaughter and the laws, the dietary laws of kashrut. increasingly these horrific laws, obviously tinged with anti-Semitism, frequently now in Western and Northern Europe, Belgium, the European Union. And, you know, they say that kosher slaughter is somehow unethical. You know, it's literally one of our seven universally applied laws is do not do this sort of terrible thing unto an animal. So I can't help but note the irony of that. Okay, so why don't we transition a little bit here? We have a big holiday coming up. That is, we Jews, and that, of course, is Passover. It probably was my favorite Jewish holiday when I was growing up. Now that I'm an adult, I think I would probably take the unpopular opinion that my favorite Jewish holiday is actually Yom Kippur, which I think is a very unpopular opinion. But Passover is deeply special in so many ways as well. So before we kind of go a little deeper, why don't we just start at kind of a base level here? For those who are not familiar with the Passover holiday, why don't you kind of just tell them what's coming up on the Jewish calendar here?
Yeah, it is actually a really not only exciting holiday for the Jewish community, but what I've found in the last decade or so is that there are a lot of folks from the Christian community as well, and those who are sort of just American Christian culturally connected, there is a certain fascination with Passover outside of the Jewish world as well, which has always been kind of interesting to me. But in any case, the basic story of Passover is the Bible kind of guides us with this family of Jacob and his sons and their families, 70 souls that go down into Egypt and they make a life for themselves. Joseph had become the vice pharaoh and life was good. They lived out the rest of their lives there. And then when Joseph dies in the beginning of the book of Exodus, the Torah tells us that a new king arose and sort of forgot the contributions that Joseph had given. And they did what a lot of anti-Semites do. They said, look, there's this group of people that, and they're growing, and they're like a nation within a nation. They live amongst themselves. They have their own family rituals. They kind of keep to themselves, and they began to enslave them for that reason, in order to kind of keep them maintained and under control. And so they enslaved the Jewish community, and the Jewish community was, this was foretold already to Abraham that his children were going to be enslaved in the land of Egypt. So several generations later, Moses is born in the beginning of Exodus, where we are introduced to Moses, and Moses grows up in Pharaoh's palace. Contrary to popular belief, Moses did actually know that he was a Hebrew. I know if from the Ten Commandments movie that would disagree, but from the biblical model, Moses knows that he is of the Jewish faith. He's welcomed into the palace, and he grows up there. And there's a certain encounter that he has in his adult life with an Egyptian taskmaster. He winds up killing him after the taskmaster is being too rough on one of the Jewish slaves, and he's forced to flee Egypt. We know the basics of the story. He marries in Midian. He makes a life for himself, and until he's confronted by God at the burning bush. Then he goes back to Egypt, inflicts 10 plagues upon the Egyptians, upon the Egyptian army, and the Jewish people are redeemed. And so the holiday of Passover that we're celebrating next week not only commemorates this event that happened 3,000 years ago, we're also trying to relive the concept of redemption in our own lives. I would say even more so whenever we have a Jewish holiday, the theme is only partially to recount what happened in the past. Our primary focus is trying to live that experience and recreate that experience in the present, which makes it much more relevant, much more real, and something that we can really envision in our own lives.
That's a very interesting note to end on, actually. Maybe we can pick up there and expound on that a little bit. So what we do for the non-Jews, there are those who might be less familiar with our customs, is we hold two big dinners, essentially, round table on the first two nights here in the diaspora outside the land of Israel, and we call that the Passover Seder. Rabbi, to your point, a lot of non-Jews have taken strong interest in the Passover Seder, especially over the past maybe 50 to 100 years or so, I think due in no small part due to the fact that the Last Supper for Jesus of Nazareth was actually a Passover Seder, which has been very interesting. And, you know, one of the affirmative mitzvahs, one of the affirmative commandments of the Passover Seder is for parents to recount the telling of the Exodus for the children. And we have all sorts of customs during the Seder, the four questions and things like that. But I think you're making a very interesting point as well, which is that there is actually another commandment as well, which is It's actually embedded, I think, Rabbi, within our daily six remembrances. So we're told to remember six things every day. One of them is the departure from Egypt. And maybe you could just expound on that a little bit, about how we're not just recounting the past, but this whole month on the Jewish calendar, this is the month of Nisan, we are continually trying to focus on redemption in our own time.
Absolutely. So the power that we have, each holiday has like a certain energy, I would say, attached to it. Not only the theme of the day, but I would say even the spiritual energy that's embedded in the air during that day, that we can kind of recharge ourselves with this particular thing. So Hanukkah would be like the energy of light over darkness. Purim would be the idea of overturning all negative decrees in our lives. Passover would represent the idea of freedom. And freedom exists on a lot of different levels, and something that's relevant for your Jewish listeners and for your non-Jewish listeners as well, because freedom is something that, I mean, we talk about it all the time. We talk about American freedom and freedom of speech and all of the freedoms that we have. But freedom is something very personal. Freedom is something that we don't really think about all that often in spiritual terms, because we are very, very much enslaved to ourselves. A smartphone is something that people can't take their eyes away from. They distract themselves from what's really actually important in life, their family members, their friends, their life experience around them. I know, Josh, you've been using the term, what is it, like go touch some grass in the past? Because like reality is happening around you, and like you can get so locked into stupid Twitter world that you forget like what life is really about. And so there are so many different things that if we're just left to our own devices, our own, forget even the smartphones. How many times a person has a nice dinner, and then they're full, they can't eat anymore, and then out comes the cake or out comes the ice cream, and all of a sudden you have a little bit more room. So at that moment in time, who's really in control? Is it you or is it the cake that's in control of you?
Right.
So whether it's physically, whether it's emotionally, that we are enslaving ourselves to the society around us, that we spend money that we don't have on things that we don't want to impress people that we don't like, right? We live in a very enslaved scenario, whether we're talking about physically, emotionally, psychologically, or spiritually. There's a lot of confinement, much of the time self-imposed confinement, but confinement nonetheless. And Passover is the symbolic days that we have, that freedom is in the air, that we can tap into this freedom for the Jewish community. That's through undergoing the ritual of the Seder. It's meant not to just think about what happened back then, but it says in the Haggadah, in the book that we to recount the Exodus, it says you should envision yourself as you yourself leaving Egypt. And that's what it means, that nowadays I think about all of the things that are enslaving me in my life. What are the things that are taking me away from what life is really about, allowing me to be my real, true, free self? What are those things enslaving me? Well, this is where I get the energy to overcome all of them.
Beautifully said, honestly. And, you know, I couldn't agree more when it comes to the soft tyranny of modern technology, smartphones and computers in particular. I know that I am very much among the first offenders when it comes to too much screen time. And, you know, I did write that recent column to your comment, Rabbi, encouraging my readers to go touch some grass. And, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't point out the irony that I am probably one of the first offenders who should listen to my own advice there. But, you know, God willing here, as we approach the Passover holiday here in the month of Nisan on the Jewish calendar, you know, maybe I can, you know, redeem myself in some ways from the soft tyranny of modern technology as well. So, you know, with that beautiful explanation said, I have a related question for you, Rabbi Taylor. And again, we're joined by Rabbi Pinchas Taylor. He's the director of American Faith Coalition, a rabbi here in South Florida, where we both live. So as we continue this conversation on Passover, and then we'll take it in a slightly different direction, but sticking to the topic for now, one thing that I am always a little torn on when it comes to this time of the calendar, when it comes to Passover, is I am a huge proponent of Jewish particularism. I am a staunch proponent of the idea that the Jewish people are not necessarily part. To be clear, we are part of a universal whole. We discussed that earlier with the Noahide laws. We are all children of God and so forth there. But I'm generally opposed to trying to extract lessons and try to extrapolate too much from the Jewish experience to the universal world. I get very wary of this. And I get wary of this in particular because I see a lot of modern left-wing politicians, Kamala Harris being a particularly egregious offender, trying to say that, oh, the Passover Seder actually means like transgender rights, or it actually means like Palestinian rights. You know, like, I mean, I'm very, very wary of going down this rabbit hole. But there is a lesson here, right? And that's kind of what you were just talking about. So maybe you can try to square the circle for me and make it so that we can try to take away lessons from Passover without running the risk of just overly politicizing this crucially and very important holiday.
Sure. I think part of the confusion sometimes is goes like this. So the Jewish people are called in the Bible the chosen people. Now, there's a lot of misunderstanding as what this chosen people means. So what chosen people means, every person, every individual human being is created in the image of God. Every person is chosen by God by virtue of their birth, by having a certain special mission. Right? God doesn't make any junk. You were made in the image of God, which every single human being is. You were chosen for a mission. God has a purpose for you. And the Jewish nation is simply chosen to teach the rest of the world that they are chosen. Like we were delegated that task as a nation to teach every individual on planet Earth that they are chosen. And so the place that we get our wisdom to do that is not in our own right. We don't just come up with ideas in our own right. We have the Torah. The Torah is our guidebook. It's the blueprint for life. And we are the disseminators of that Torah in a way that is palatable for the rest of the world to understand, the value system, the spiritual concepts, the connection with God that makes for a moral life. And so if we as a Jewish community are learning or getting our Torah understanding from the outside world, well, we're doing it in the wrong direction. So I would never, for many reasons, but I would never say, okay, well, Passover, the message of the Seder is obviously for transgender rights, like Kamala Harris says, because again, it has nothing to do with transgender rights. The transgender rights is its own discussion, but that's not what the Seder is about. And that's not what Hanukkah is about, right? We each has its own message that is very relevant and very real. And when we do water it down too much, yeah, it does lose all of its meaning. I think as Rabbi Sachs put it best, and I love this concept, that non-Jews respect Jews that respect Judaism. And if a Jewish person is living and embodying what the Torah says, like truly, not just doing it on the outside, but really truly doing their best to live up to how the Torah tells us to live, non-Jewish people respect that. Some of my greatest friends and admirers of life, of the life that I live, are outside of the Jewish faith, are not Jewish people themselves. And so I think that it's very important for us to make an impact on the world by strengthening our connection with what we have. So I think, and to your point, to squaring this, the way in which we influence the world is through developing this sort of, I don't say insular, but very much focused on what does the Torah say, not trying to come up with my own ideas and then make it fit with what the Torah says. Learn what the Torah says, live what the Torah says, and that itself will accomplish our mission by spreading out to the rest of the world around us.
Beautifully said. So Passover, as we've kind of alluded to, you know, the extent to which it can be universally extrapolated, we were just discussing here. I think that's a subject of fair debate. But the reality is people have used the imagery of the Exodus from Egypt for a very, very long time in many, many different contexts. And, you know, you and I have multiple things in common. One of them is the fact that we are devout American patriots and we love the political theory of the American founding and the statesmanship of Abraham Lincoln, all these great things. And, you know, I'm sure I'm not breaking news to you when I tell you that, you know, Benjamin Franklin famously wanted the Great Seal of the United States to be Moses parting the Red Sea. And, you know, unfortunately, he lost that debate. I can't quite remember. I think it was Thomas Jefferson who opposed, but I could be mistaken about that. In any event, The imagery of the Passover Seder and this idea of redemption is really kind of woven throughout Americana. You know, Abraham Lincoln famously referred to America as an almost chosen people, clearly going off of the biblical idea of a chosen people that you and I were just discussing here. You know, I'm wondering if there's anything specifically about the Passover holiday that, you know, resonates with you, kind of looking at your theory of the American founding and your kind of view of American history more broadly.
Sure. So it's so beautiful how much not only our founding fathers, but even predating the founding, that they really saw themselves as the embodiment of of the Israelites. They saw themselves wanting to seek religious freedom from everyone on the Mayflower, looking at themselves escaping to religious freedom, religious tyranny in Europe, and coming to the United States to establish what would be eventually the United States as a place that was like the promised land. The early founders, even predating the American founding, viewed the Atlantic Ocean as like the Red Sea, that they were parting to the other side and then making their way to the promised land. And so that's a theme that you find continually through the American founding. There are many writings as the American Revolution was getting underway, comparing King George III to Pharaoh and how the new world established as the promised land to be able to live in a world of freedom. And this theme is something that you find not only on the Mayflower and the American Revolution, it's something that you find really down the road. You found it all through the Civil War, the imagery of Abraham Lincoln being compared to Moses, who ironically enough was killed during Passover that year, which wow. Again, kind of strengthens that imagery, right? He was in April of, of 1865. Yeah. And so it was during Passover even Jewish community there were many Jewish communities around the country that were, for lack of a better term, sitting Shiva, right? They were actually grieving, mourning the death of President Lincoln. And so that really strengthens the imagery as well. And you find even throughout the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King, the night before he was assassinated, quoting Moses and bringing it into the idea of Moses looking into the promised land. And so this trend of an enslaved people, or people that feel oppressed, they can't connect with God, they can't live a life of freedom in the way that they want to because of oppressors, we find it again throughout our history. It is really something beautiful. It is something that I have always loved about America, and I think it's encouraging that we continue that trend to live a life that is full of freedom. And the end goal should be to live in the promised land. That America should be a promised land, a land that really does radiate freedom, that really does radiate what our core values are all about, why this place was founded in the first place. And the more we strengthen our history, the foundations of our history, the more easily I think that we achieve our destiny.
So that kind of leads me into the present. And, you know, I don't think I'm alone, you know, speaking of needing to go touch some grass and get off of modern technology. But I don't think that I am alone in noticing that there has been a noticeable upsurge in anti-Semitism coming from certain pockets of social media, certain pockets of the internet in the now 6+ months since the atrocities of October 7, 2023, but both on the far left and, I guess if you can call it the far right, I don't happen to like that label very much. I don't think it's very accurate, but we can call it for simplicity purposes, the far left and the far right. And, you know, I don't want to over-exaggerate this because we actually do have fairly recent polling on this. I think it was from Pew, one of the nation's most esteemed pollsters. And there was a Pew poll that I saw either last year or the year before that, I think it was last year, where they basically do a cross-tab poll where they poll every religionist, every a person of every faith within the country, and they essentially ask them whether they have a positive or negative impression of different faiths other than their own. And Judaism had one of the most positive plus minuses of any religion in America, actually. So I don't want to over-exaggerate this. America continues to be a generally pro-Jewish, philo-Semitic country. Public polling continually shows the American people support Israel over Hamas, of course. But having said all that, there has been this noticeable recent upsurge in social media chatter. On this show, I have been very outspoken against those like Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson, who have in various ways played into this without getting overly accusatory and using labels I don't necessarily want to use right now. But having said all that, Rabbi, I guess the question is, you know, from your perch, you know, as a Torah observant Jew, as someone steeped in American patriotism and American history, what would be your message to both Jews and probably even more so non-Jews, Christians who are kind of seeing some of this chatter and dabbling with the idea of, you know, maybe we actually can get America, maybe we can get Western civilization without Judaism? To me, it doesn't make any sense at all. What do you say?
So it is an interesting point, and it is unfortunate. What like we call the horseshoe effect, where you have the extreme on one side and the extreme on the other side, they kind of meet. There's certain things that they meet on, not just with anti-Semitism, but there's various issues that you wind up coming full circle for. You have different reasons for it, or that you attribute it to, but you wind up coming full circle at the bottom. So as far as the folks on the right. I don't want to whitewash anyone or anybody. I think a lot of times stereotypes and anti-Semitism in particular, but stereotypes in general, they come from having a bad experience. Person has bad experience with one type of person from a particular group. All of a sudden, all those sorts of people, and then you start noticing. I mean, like confirmation bias is a really powerful thing. We don't even realize that we're doing it, and we say, "Oh!" All of a sudden, you start finding all sorts of examples. Like, yeah, not only that guy cheat me, but look, that same type of person cheated that person, and that same type of person did that bad thing to that person, and all of a sudden, it's this whole cabal of people that are conspiring together to come against you. I'd imagine that a lot of these folks, and again, I'm giving benefit of the doubt, but I think a lot of these people just didn't have that much exposure to religious Jews in their life. They are making certain projections about Jews and Judaism, very little knowledge. And as far as them personally, I think they're probably just overgeneralizing, they're uninformed. But the downside is that I don't think they really particularly seek to be informed. And to seek to make relationships with people that are actually observant of Judaism. Some of the attempts to sort of educate them also, I think were, you know, doing more harm sometimes than good. You don't just go on and yell at somebody. I think what's happened also on the right and on the left and every which way is that in order to brand yourself, you have to do something, I guess, that makes you niche and unique, right? Or you can just be like everybody else. And so you push the line to make yourself different. And then all of a sudden you've pushed the line so far that you're like outside the scope of reality now. And so whatever that issue is, if you have all these people that are like trying to brand themselves as I'm this person or I'm that person, or this is what my organization. And like we're different, and this is why we're different. And if you keep pushing that line, the farther you go, you're gonna lose sight of reality. I think that's what's happened with some of the folks, both on the right and the left, is that they've gone so far just off the deep end that it's become completely conspiratorial, and you know, we've lost sight of reality. I think it is important for us to clarify terms, to have real discussions and debate with people, but not on camera. I'm not afraid of the camera, but I think the camera is there in order to create good TV or to create good radio, create good podcasts. And people like hearing the debates and the discussion. But I think to really influence people, to really have a normal, honest discussion about the issues, if someone has a relationship with these people, have a discussion about it, like in private. So it's not just each person trying to one up the other, make their point to get more clicks or whatever it is, so they can have their Instagram reel, show whatever. Oh, they own the other person. That's not what this is about. To really have an honest conversation where hearts and minds are really changed. I think this is done behind the cameras. Not out of fear of cameras, but out of just that there's no other. Extraneous reasons that you're talking the way that you're talking It's just to have a real normal discussion. And I'm personally open to having a discussion, private discussion, with anyone who would like to, anyone that's listening to this show that would like more clarity, that would just kind of like to educate themselves or discuss, hey, what's this all about, in an honest way, because there's lots of rumors about a lot of different things. And I'd be happy in whatever part I can play behind closed. But again, nothing public. I don't want any mention. But that is the way that we really change hearts and minds, is not by doing things in a public fashion for clicks. It's really having a down to earth discussion and saying, look, these are the things that are important. These are the things that we believe. These are the things that we do. And this is why we do them. And now you understand much more than some meme or some reel that you saw. And now you think you understand everything about everything.
Yeah, this is one of the lessons that I have previously, by my own admission, been an offender on, but I have really tried to take to heart over the past 2-3 years or so, is that which can be handled privately ought to be handled privately. There is no reason to take a feud or a discussion, a pointed criticism, any of that public, unless there was a compelling reason to do so. But the baseline presumption, unless you have real strong reasons to do that, the baseline presumption and course of conduct should be to keep it private. I have, again, by my own admission, I've been an offender of this in prior years, but over the past 2-3 years, I really have tried to kind of learn that lesson myself. So Rabbi Taylor, this has been a really wonderful discussion. Let's get you out of here with this. We've talked a lot about the history of America and Passover and lessons both for Jews and for non-Jews here. Do you sit there and do you find yourself optimistic about the future of Jewish life in America? I think I know what the answer is going to be, but I figured I had to ask you.
Oh, absolutely, I do. I hope that was the answer that you were
expecting. It was.
Listen, sometimes when we're going through something, it's difficult to keep context in play. If you look at what's going on around us, not just in the Jewish world, but we look at how the way in which society is going, and we think, you know, people are becoming so divided and politics is so divided. And that is true. And that might be more divided or seemingly more divided than any other time in our history. It's not. When we talk about politicians, people were eating at each other's throats since the beginning. And we did actually fight a civil war. So, I mean, like, we have been divided before. And again, I don't want it to get that messy. God forbid there should be a physical civil war, God forbid. But we have been that divided, and America has triumphed. When I think about my parents and grandparents' generation, when they would want to join some country club or whatever, they would see a sign, or there would be just it would just be the known thing that Jews can't apply there. We don't have that anymore. We don't have that anymore. And there's certainly been quite a bit of stride. So yes, there are a lot of loud people that are making their voices known on both left and right nowadays, and it seems like it's all coming for us. But as you mentioned before, according to polling data, according to surveys and studies, the vast majority of the American public is still very much with the Jewish people. That America as a whole is a morally good country, that people, not the politicians and not the people in the media, I'm talking about your average person that is your neighbor, is your friend, is your community member, whatever it is, that those are good people. Those are oftentimes God-fearing people. And there's no squabble. It's the tension and the whole mess is with the politicians and the media people. Your average person is, at least from my point of view, is still a good, trying to make it for their family, trying to live a good life, be a good example. And I don't think there's all that much that's going to change that.
Well, I wholeheartedly agree with that. And that very much was the answer that I was expecting and the answer with which I agree. So, you know, on that warm and uplifting note, Rabbi Pinchas Taylor is the director of the American Faith Coalition and a good friend here in our South Florida community. Thank you so much for joining the Josh Hammer Show today.
Josh, always a pleasure to see you.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. Auto Trader.